Do you love Elon Musk? Do you hate Elon Musk? Do you have no idea what to think about Elon Musk? Then we have just the show for you.
He's become even more larger than life.
Buying Twitter doesn't get us closer to Mars.
They are like really close to the edge of like everything falling apart.
Like, oh, Elon, I volunteer, put a chip in my brain.
Each week on this podcast, we'll break down, analyze, and debate the most important stories on Musk and his empire.
It's all one big universe. You just work for Elon Inc.
From Bloomberg Businessweek, this is Elon Inc. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
It does show the sort of strain that the market is under this winter.
It's very rare to hear the chief economist of the Bank of England being so frank about Brexit.
I think that what's more problematic for policy in the UK is following these basics so that people make decisions on the basis of the full picture.
Stephen, I would like to have a small rant.
Oh, just a small one. That's a relief.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Caroline Hepke.
And I'm Stephen Carroll. Welcome to the programme. Today, Prime Minister's questions on a day when we will be hearing also from the President of Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky, in the UK. His second visit outside of Ukraine since the war started almost a year ago. He is going to be addressing Parliament later on, so we can expect that to be one of the big themes that comes up during today's Prime Minister's questions as well. Of course, something that Rishi Sunak has taken over. Boris Johnson made, his support of Ukraine a very large part of his premiership, and even afterwards as well. So something that Rishi Sunak taking up with this visit.
Yes, absolutely. Remember, it's about a year ago that Zelensky, made it, that sort of Churchillian speech via satellite link, via video to Parliament at the start of the war, the invasion by Russia into Ukraine. It could well be quite a serious PMQs then today. Also, though, aside from Ukraine, quite interesting, Stephen, people reading into the comments by the new Tory chairman, Greg Hands, the hints about when we might see another general election. He talked about the next 18 months will see us win or lose the next general election. Of course, the election has to happen within 2 years, but is that a clue as to the timing of the next round of voting?
Had a lot of people, I think, counting on their fingers when they got that email. This is an email that went out to Tory party members after Greg Hands was selected or chosen as the new chairperson of the Conservative Party. So this 18 months has put people wondering, okay, well, that means obviously the government is planning to have this election before the end of 2024 and several months before the end of 2024 as well. Let's go to Parliament and listen in to Keir Starmer, the Labour leader.
1,000 people have died as a result of the devastating earthquake in Turkey and Syria, and that number is sadly rising. And I know many families here in the UK will be anxiously awaiting news. I'm sure I speak for the whole House in saying our hearts go out to each and every victim and their families, and we must do all we can to support the rescue and recovery effort. Mr. Speaker, this House is honoured to be addressed today by President Zelensky. From the outset of the war, he has symbolised the heroism, the resolve, and the bravery of his people. The Prime Minister and I joined this House together in 2015. We've lived through important moments in our domestic and international politics. But none of those experiences compares to the pain and suffering of the people of Ukraine. Does the Prime Minister agree with me that right across this House, it is vital that we all continue to stand together in full support of Ukraine?
Yeah. Prime Minister.
Well, can I first join with the Honourable Member for paying our respects and thoughts to the people of Turkey and Syria, particularly those affected by the earthquake and the first responders who are doing such a valiant job. The House will be reassured to know that we are in touch with the Turkish and Syrian authorities and providing all assistance that they have required of us, including 77 search and rescue responders that arrived yesterday and have already begun work. And I spoke to the President yesterday to ensure that we are in close communication. And can I thank the Honourable Gentleman for his comments on Ukraine? It's something that not only the whole country can be proud of, but the entire House can be proud that we came together to stand by Ukraine when the moment mattered, and that we will continue to stand with them united as one Parliament. Parliament and one United Kingdom.
Just for the record, he is the Right Honourable. Keir Starmer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and I thank the Prime Minister for that answer, because every time Putin has been appeased, he's been back for more. And so does the Prime Minister agree with me that across this House we must speak with one voice and say this terrible conflict must end with the defeat of Putin in Ukraine?
Mr. Speaker, our objective remains to ensure a Ukrainian victory in this conflict. Vladimir Putin's aggression cannot be seen in any way to have been successful, and that's why we have accelerated and increased our support militarily for Ukraine this year. It's a decision that I took as Prime Minister. Today we are going even further, not just having provided Challenger tanks and being one of the first countries to do so, which catalysed the provision of tanks from other nations as well, but also today to move to start training Ukrainian Marines in the advanced capabilities they will need to mount further offensive, but also to train their pilots on advanced combat aircraft. So the House can be reassured we will continue to support Ukraine to ensure decisive military victory on the battlefield this year.
Yes, Starmer.
Mr. Speaker, can I welcome the additional support the Prime Minister has outlined today? I've had the privilege, I'm sure he has, of seeing firsthand the brilliant work our military is doing in Salisbury to train Ukrainians in defending themselves. We all support this work and the UK's role in the international drive to ensure that Ukraine has the weapons and the technology required to defend herself. Does the Prime Minister agree that continuing this international effort is the only way to ensure Putin's defeat?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the House may not all be aware that actually we have continued to train Ukrainian soldiers because it's something that we have done for years before the conflict started and something that we should be very proud of. But obviously we've intensified those efforts. Last year we trained 10,000 Ukrainian soldiers through Operation Interflex. This year the Defence Secretary announced that last year we'll be training 20,000 Ukrainian soldiers in addition to the Marines and Air Force pilots that I mentioned earlier. But the Right Honourable Gentleman is right to highlight this has been an international effort. One thing that is a mark of UK leadership in this particular area is that around a dozen other countries have all come here to the Ukraine, to the UK to take part in our training programmes to support Ukrainian soldiers. Many members from around this House will have visited in their constituencies that effort. It's something that's making an incredible difference on the ground, and I know something that the President Zelensky is incredibly grateful for.
Yeah. Yes, Starmer.
I think the whole House would like to thank those involved in the incredible training that is going on. Mr. Speaker, before I entered this House, I had responsibility for fighting for justice in The Hague for victims of Serbian aggression. Does the Prime Minister agree with me that when the war in Ukraine is over, Putin and all his cronies must stand at The Hague and face justice?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the Right Honourable Gentleman is absolutely right that we must hold those to account for the horrific crimes that they have committed. I'm proud that the United Kingdom has played again a leadership role in this regard, being one of the first countries to provide financial and technical support, putting investigators on the ground. We're shortly to be hosting a conference together with the Dutch. And also, one of the things I discussed with President Zelensky this morning is our support for the work of the ICC, where, thanks to the efforts of UK members, I'm hopeful that we will see the first indictments very shortly.
Keir Starmer.
Mr. Speaker, across this House, we don't just hope for Ukraine's victory, we believe in it. And part of that victory must be Ukraine's reconstruction. Does the Prime Minister agree with me that Russia should pay for the destruction it has caused through the wealth lying dormant in blocked Russian government assets?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, we are the third largest humanitarian and economic donor to Ukraine, £1.4 billion of support that we have provided through direct grant assistance and guarantees at multilateral lending organisations. And again, the House will remember we took a lead in imposing economic sanctions on Russian entities, including individuals and state-sanctioned assets. We've ensured the provision of funds here will be put in a foundation for reconstruction in Ukraine, and we are currently working with international partners through the legal process to use those assets to fund Ukrainian reconstruction. Of course, that's something that we all want to see, and we're working with our partners to achieve that.
Keir Starmer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. As a country, we've always been at our best when we stand up to tyrannical aggressors threatening their neighbours and peace on our continent. That's why the Labour Party helped found NATO, and why our commitment to NATO is as unshakable today as it was back then. Does the Prime Minister agree with me that whatever differences we may have, no matter what difficulties we face as a country, we in this House have a duty to stand on the shoulders of giants who came before us and support Ukraine's fight for freedom, liberty and victory?
Well, Mr. Speaker, we remain the leading European ally in NATO, as we always have done. We continue to increase funding in our armed forces by £24 billion at the last spending review to ensure that we maintain not just our NATO obligation to spend 2% of our GDP on defence, but also we participate in every NATO operation and remain the leading nation when it comes to contributions to NATO's Rapid Response Force and the NATO Readiness Initiative. But I join with the Right Honourable Gentleman in saying that this House and this country will stand united with Ukraine until we ensure the defeat of Vladimir Putin's unprovoked, unsanctioned aggression, and that we will make sure that Ukraine is not only victorious, but that we bring peace to its people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Global Combat Air Programme, including Team Tempest, is vital for UK national security and for the world-class aerospace cluster we've got in Lancashire, with many businesses in Burnley and Paddington. This aircraft will protect UK skies, give the RAF the tools it needs for the future, and deepen our relationship with allies like Japan and Italy. So can I ask the Prime Minister, with a refresh of the integrated review taking place, to commit not just to the design and development of this aircraft, but to its production in Lancashire too, providing skilled jobs for generations to come for my constituents and residents all across the county of Lancashire?
Mr. Speaker, I was delighted to announce this landmark international partnership with Japan and Italy in December. Team Tempest partners already employ 2,500 people in the UK, with over 1,200 in the Northwest. And as we are making more progress, we're going to continue to invest in skills and technology at the BAE Systems Factory of the Future in Lancashire.
Stephen Flynn, Leader of the SNP.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and on behalf of my party, I'd like to send our condolences to all of those impacted by the devastating earthquake in Turkey and Syria, and also to welcome the exchange between the Leader of the Opposition and the Prime Minister in respect of Ukraine. We all in this House are united in our condemnation of Vladimir Putin and in our hope for a better future for Ukraine. It will be an honour for all of us to listen to President Zelensky this afternoon. Mr. Speaker, in recent days, the former Prime Minister said that she did not regret her time in office. Does the Prime Minister regret her time in office?
I think I'm clear on which one, Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful to all my predecessors for the contribution that they make to public life. Can I join with the Right Honourable Gentleman in saying that I know the whole House will be looking forward to hearing from President Zelensky at the conclusion of PMQs.
Okay, so that was the exchange then for Prime Minister's questions between Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer, ahead, of course, of the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky addressing Parliament this afternoon. Look, I think that the most important line out of that was surely the Prime Minister talking about ensuring a decisive military victory on the battlefield this year. So the UK, of course, has handed over, or is in the process of handing over Challenger 2 tanks to Ukraine. That is more symbolic than, I think, material to the battlefield, but the Prime Minister did highlight how that opened the door to other countries sending those important tanks for that fight.
We heard in those exchanges also talk about the training efforts that have been for Ukrainian soldiers and how more than a dozen other countries have come to the UK to help in that training effort to try and support Ukraine as well. And interesting to hear Keir Starmer, of course, himself a former prosecutor, bringing up the role of the International Criminal Court and Rishi Sunak saying that he hopes to see the first indictments shortly from the ICC over Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and to see that that would be a process that would start to begin soon as well, that there would be international justice seen or and that process would begin, as he said, shortly.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there is an issue, though, and there is an excellent piece if you want more details around the issue of defence spending in Britain. France and Germany are spending more. The UK, as was pointed out in that PMQs, is spending more. Saw a big increase in defence spending in the last round of spending announcements. And yet there has been a warning by top military leaders in the US that they're worried about the capabilities of Britain, that it's no longer a significant fighting force. And that's been a real worry for Ben Wallace.
Yeah, and the increase in funding to armed forces, of course, we heard Rishi Sunak there talk about the last increase that they made to maintain the NATO obligation of spending 2% of GDP. But as you say, Caroline, concerns elsewhere about whether or not that is sufficient to provide the funding for a modern force. Rishi Sunak pointing out they do participate in every NATO operation as well. We did just hear, though, in that final question from Stephen Flynn, the Westminster leader of the SNP, reference to a different political story. And this, of course, is Liz Truss and her weekend essay talking about her time as Prime Minister. And that's something that we've been discussing as well with one of our guests.
Yeah, of course. The UK's shortest serving Prime Minister. I mean, she attempted something of a political comeback in the last few days. On that issue, we spoke to Gavin McGaw, who is the Group Managing Director at Hanover Communications, someone who once worked himself for the Conservative Party. Now we asked him about rebranding and whether Liz Truss's attempt has been successful, as well as Rishi Sunak's recent mini reshuffle.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Heard, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I think the use of rebranding is often incorrect when we look at politics. Usually it's tweaking or reframing arguments or narratives. And it's very, very different to the business sector, where it tends to be more strategic and to be much more authentic in terms of having an impact on what a business is doing. In politics, it's simply trying to get headlines and trying to change the narrative in some way. With Liz Truss, I see it more as doubling down than rebranding. What she's clearly seen is she has an opportunity to influence a small number of people still with particular messages, and it will give her a sense of worth within the Conservative Party and British politics. And she sees this as an opportunity to stamp her authority in those areas, particularly in terms of growth and taxation. Now, she's probably right on that, but you don't get to screw up the job of Prime Minister to the extent that she has and get to come back to have another go at the top job. But she will, with this sort of positioning, give herself a voice on an ongoing basis within the political world.
Okay, so if you say that this isn't really an example of rebranding, we are hearing that the election may well, there are hints at least, that the election may well, general election may well come within 18 months. So is it that the Tories have to rebrand the party as a whole, or is it, again, a kind of tweaking of the message? You know, what do you think Rishi Sunak has to do to try to win that general election?
I think Rishi Sunak's just desperately trying to make the party seem like it has a plan and that it is fit for purpose in some way for the British population. I think that's his only plan. That's why we're seeing a sort of quiet approach from Rishi. I was with a friend recently who's a farmer, and he was telling me about what they do to fields when they've given up their crops, and they put something in. They put something in called cover crop, which allows the fields to regenerate, but does absolutely no damage when it's plied up. It can go into what's seeded next in the fields. And that's clearly what Rishi is for the country. He's the cover crop, really, to get us through these difficult times. It doesn't mean he's going to be hugely popular. It probably doesn't mean he's going to win an election, but he's got a job to do to look competent. And that's his job, not only for himself, but for the Conservative Party, because it's been such a chaotic few years. They really are burning their bridges. You know, you saw William Hague this week talk about leaders who don't listen and don't admit they got things wrong, how toxic that is, not only for the wider electorate, but particularly for the party. And I think that Rishi Sunak's desperately trying to just give that feeling that there is a complacency. There's not complacency at the top, but there's competence at the top.
Is that enough to try and move the narrative that is around the Conservative Party? Does he need to go further than simply just projecting an image of competence?
It's definitely not enough, but I think it's all he has, because it has been so, so bad. You know, those people who, for instance, recently we heard there was the Cabinet Away Day where they talked about whether they could repeat the lessons of the 1992 election. It's as if these people have not been listening to what has been happening over the last few years. We've got people getting pension fund updates and learning they've lost thousands of pounds. We're seeing people having to pay thousands of pounds extra in mortgage payments and energy payments and all of those. Those things will come back and hit you when an election happens, no matter what you do at this stage. So reframing yourself and trying to look the part is one thing, but the true impact on the wider population that we've seen as a result of both Boris Johnson and Liz Truss's failures over a number of years now really will hit the Conservative Party. And I really fear that the next election is going to be a really damaging one for it. But then again, maybe it needs that.
Yeah, so basically Rishi Sunak is no John Major is your the short view. In that case, then, what do you make of the opposition? Because, yes, the Tories may be 20 points behind in the polls, but, you know, Keir Starmer has some issues with voters if you drill down into the polling. And also there are quite similar messages, very little detail on what a Labour Party wants in terms of any election manifesto that, you know, has yet to come, of course. But, you know, trying to stake out, for example, the business ground, you know, the Tories and the Labour Party are both using virtually the same phrase.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating. And when you talk about rebranding in politics, you know, the ones that have actually worked are probably Blair, his modernisation of the Labour Party in the early 90s, in the mid 90s, you know, removing Clause 4. Even David Cameron got it right to a certain extent with his modernisation and big society. The question around Keir Starmer is, what is his vision? What is his purpose in politics? So going back to business speak, he's got to set that out and he's got to tell us what those things are and what his values are. He's clearly trying to move closer to business to, as a defensive move, as much as anything, to try and show that they can be competent with that in mind. And, you know, they've been at Davos recently. They've got a lot of praise for what they've done. And, you know, the business leaders I speak to are certainly wanting to know more from them, but they've not really set the world alight yet. You know, and this is where we've got a weird moment in politics where Rishi Sunak's just appearing to be competent. Keir Starmer's trying to be competent. We're not trying to put a foot wrong, but at some stage this is going to have to change. And Keir Starmer's going to have to reveal what his actual mission is from a political perspective.
I wonder whether, you know, the ground, the fertile ground for Labour and for Keir Starmer's Labour might be on crime. And, you know, that's sort of one of the themes that perhaps people say is something that worries voters, that could actually be a kind of a big election issue, a kind of one that's perhaps slightly out of sight, although maybe not for Londoners given the issues with the Metropolitan Police. But is that perhaps a campaigning ground for Keir Starmer that you might envisage?
Well, I think what's really interesting is the polling clearly shows there's five key campaigning areas, and Rishi Sunak set out five promises in regard to those. So there's the economy and financial security. There's jobs, trying to get more jobs in. And that's where maybe there'll be a bit of disagreement between the Tories and Labour, because the Labour Party will see more of an industrial strategy on that, whilst Rishi Sunak maybe less focused on the industrial side. Trying to get national debt down is clearly going to have to do something which both parties do better on, and Keir Starmer needs to set out how he's going to do that and keep all the other constituents and stakeholders he has happy. You know, NHS, absolutely. And then you bring in immigration and law as the final area here, which undoubtedly, you're right, people want to see movement on. Keir Starmer is going to have to grab something in that area and show a vision, but it's really difficult. But what I would say about all these things, that's the polling that's coming from the public. Great leaders lead. They show this is the direction that we need to go in. Here's why we do what we do. And I found it really interesting last year, whenever the Q archives showed up the documents from New Labour's early years. And I was working for the Conservative Party back then, but I went and had a look at some of the documentation from Downing Street under Tony Blair and his new administration in 1997. And they had a clear mission and a clear strategy that came through in all those documents. That's missing in politics, and it has been missing in politics for many years. And as a result, politicians are thinking short-term instead of long-term. And we need someone, whether it's a new leader of the Conservative Party or whether it's Keir Starmer, to start trying to lead the country in a direction, not just respond to what works from a polling perspective, because that is short-termism, and that's not healthy for the country.
So that was Gavin McGaugh, Group Managing Director at Hanover Communications, speaking to us a little earlier. Really fascinating to have his insights on where the Labour Party goes from here and how it capitalises on that poll lead and the idea of the party needing to show, I suppose, leadership in a particular direction rather than perhaps being a little vague, as we have had criticism of some of the policy proposals so far.
Yeah, absolutely. Labour's defence, of course, wait and see. The full layout of the agenda for the Labour Party won't come until closer to the general election. Meanwhile, for the rest of the day, we're going to be focused on the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky addressing Parliament here in the UK. That's it from us for today, though. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe. Give it 5 stars so other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
Share widely. Tell a friend. Join us. We're here every day. This episode was produced by Chris Pitt. Marufal Hussain was on sound. I'm Stephen Carroll.
And I'm Caroline Hepke. We'll be back with more tomorrow. This is Bloomberg UK Politics.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Heard, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.